the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
It's Culture Club time, and we're delighted to be joined by Ciara Geraghty today, the novelist who, after 10 books for adults, has written her first children's book, Wanda Broom. Thank you very much, Ciara, for joining us. What has persuaded you to start writing for children?
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me. It really kind of wasn't a conscious decision, I have to say. I would consider myself very much a writer of stories for adults. But then lockdown happened and everything changed. And suddenly my lovely haven in my home where I wrote was invaded by teenagers and husbands and dogs and, you know, things. And it was just kind of bedlam. And I got very precious for the first good few weeks, like coming into months about my work. And even though I had deadlines and stuff, I couldn't really seem to work because I was like, it's not, you know, I'm used to the quiet. I can't work in these conditions, you know, getting all very entitled and all that kind of stuff. And it was really worrying though, because I mean, this is how I earn my living. Do you know what I mean? I was like, what am I going to do? So, you know, I was going through, as I sometimes do when I'm stuck for ideas or I need a bit of inspiration, I was going through old notebooks of mine, and I came upon my very first notebook, which I bought down in Tremor in 2004, I think. And in there was sort of a couple of character sketches of Wanda Broom and the first kind of sort of a chapter. And a
so you originally, when you decided to turn to writing, you had been thinking of children's fiction, had you?
Yeah, no, I hadn't been reading. I mean, I'd been reading to my own children, yeah. So maybe that was in my mind. But for whatever reason, I just had this idea about this girl, you know, and all she wants to be is an ordinary girl, but her mother is a witch, so it's a bit tricky. Not only is she a witch, but she's a super bad witch. You know, she's not evil, but she's just bad at being a witch. So she's always getting into trouble. And so they're always having to move. And Wanda is always having to be the new girl in school. And so she just tries to get along and keep a low profile, keep her head below the radar and that. And then so the book starts with Wanda. They've just moved to a place called Rocky Hollow. She's starting out trying to, you know, keep a low profile, but she meets a girl. She makes a friend. Her mother has to do this assessment. If she doesn't pass the assessment, she can no longer be a witch. So I suppose the conundrum for Wanda is that, you know, part of her kind of wants her mother to fail because then she can have what she thinks she's always wanted, which is an ordinary life.
And is this going to be a new career for you now, writing for children?
Well, I suppose it depends on, you know, if the publishers want me to write another book. I'll say yes.
Will you continue writing adult fiction?
Yeah, in fact, my latest adult novel is coming out at the end of this month on the 31st of July and it's called Late Learner. So absolutely, yeah, that's kind of my first love. Wanda Broom was very much a lockdown project because during lockdown, when I was having all this angst about my writer's block, it freed up something in me because I think also I had no contract. You know, nobody was waiting for this. There was no deadline. So it kind of freed me up to write it. And that in turn sort of, you know, unfroze my writer's block.
Let's go to your Culture Club choices. And we ask every guest on the Culture Club to start by remembering the first piece of music, be it a single or what, that they ever bought. And you remember the Eurythmics and what track?
Yeah, that's right. Who's That Girl? Annie Lennox. I absolutely adored her. Now, when you say I didn't really buy a lot of music as a teenager, you know, pocket money was pretty scarce. And unfortunately for me, I discovered smoking at the school disco in second year. So
an expensive habit.
Well, back then, in fairness, you could buy 10 cigarettes, a box of matches and a packet of Polo. For under £1.
And the packet of Polo have been very important for your breath, but it wouldn't take the smell out of your clothes though, would it?
No, but my father smoked in the house, you know, like old fathers back in the 80s, you know, he smoked in the car, smoked in the house, smoked everywhere. And so we all stank of cigarettes. So that was fine. But it was in relation to my pocket money an expensive habit. So I didn't buy an awful lot of music. But when I heard Annie Lennox singing Who's That Girl? It just kind of stopped me in my tracks. And she also just stopped me as well because she was so startling to look at. You know, she had this powerful kind of androgynous look about her. And, you know, she that sort of defied the male gaze, if you like. Do you know what I mean? She was like no one I'd ever seen before. And also she had this fabulous, really buzz cut, bright red hair. And I had red hair. I have red hair. And so I kind of felt a bit seen by her. And then her lyrics were so amazing. She was just this really powerful, you know, feminist. And I suppose, yeah, she's definitely one of my earlier role models.
It's funny you say with the red hair, because I just have this vision of her as bottle blonde or as a peroxide.
Yeah, she wasn't, I don't think, you know, a natural redhead, but she had her hair for this particular video dyed startlingly bright red, you know.
Let's hear a little bit of Who's That Girl? Lennox, Dave Stewart, The Eurythmics. It's so many years since I last heard that, Ciara, and I'd just forgotten how many layers there are to that particular piece of music, and also just the strength of Annie Lennox's voice.
Yeah, and she can still produce that quality in her voice. She's incredible. Yeah, no, absolutely. That takes me back. And when the drums come in like that, it just makes me, it's one of those songs that I will, you know, grab the sweeping brush in my kitchen and, you know, sing along to and dance to, and just make it, just brings me back to those gorgeous teenage summer days.
I think there's a theme of strong women running through your choices as well, because you've given us two favourite albums. The first one is No Need to Argue by the Cranberries.
That's right, Dolores O'Riordan, God rest her beautiful soul. But this album is so iconic for me because it was released, or at least she was touring it in Australia in 1994, and I was living there in 1994 with my then boyfriend. But then I asked him to marry me in May of 1994. He said he would. So we went ahead and got married that year. So my abiding memory of this album is basically the Cranberries were always about a week ahead of us on our travels around Australia. So, you know, we'd be in Alice Springs and we would just have missed them by a week. And they were touring this particular album. And it's kind of like the soundtrack of those heady days in Australia and being young and being in love and just having, you know, adventures in the Australian sunshine.
Did you ever catch up with the Cranberries and see them there?
Never saw her live, which I have massive regret about. I don't know why. You know, when you're 24, you just think, oh, look.
The chance will come at some other stage.
I'll do it again, you know, because life just seems endlessly long and, you know, death is just a vague rumour. So I'm like, now it's too late. And I do regret that.
Zombie is on that album, and Zombie has become just such a theme song for Munster rugby fans.
That's right. Munster,
and now the Ireland team at the last World Cup as well.
Yeah, yeah. And her voice, what I loved about her voice as well was the way she sang in her Limerick accent, and what an accent it was, and it worked so well, and it just made her sound so much more authentic than she already did, you know. And her lyrics were just so beautiful, just so full of heartache and loss and grief, but also, you know, she could be political as well. She had things to say, and I just think, a bit like Sinead O'Connor, who I'm also a big fan of, who also died too young. She was kind of, you know, fame sort of did her down a bit. You know, they were mistreated in the industry. It's a very, very hard industry, especially back then, and probably even now as well, particularly for women.
Your other choice was Sinead O'Connor and her album I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. So before we talk about Sinead O'Connor, let's hear a little bit of The Emperor's New Clothes. Any info?
so. You ask if I'm scared and I said so.
Sinead O'Connor, The Emperor's New Clothes from the album I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. Why did you choose that album?
I mean, I also love The Lion and the Cobra, which was her first album. But this second album, it had still all of that rage and all of that passion, but it also had this beautiful emotional depth to it that could just make me weep, you know, listening to songs like Troy. And just the power of her voice and how, and the cover of the album, I don't know if you remember, but it's her face, you know, and it's just so captivating and it's also so vulnerable as well. You can see that sort of vulnerability in her and just makes me want to, you know, pick her up and run her away from the world that, you know, had been so cruel to her and sort of continued in that vein for all of the rest of her life, really. I mean, when this second album came out, Sinead was everything that I'd been warned about. You know, she was a skinhead. She was a single mother. She was fearless in the face of authority. You know, we were told to be good girls and to be quiet and, you know, and respect your elders kind of thing. She did none of that. She spoke truth to power and she was like the best role model that a girl kind of struggling out of the repression of the 80s could ever possibly have. Nothing Compares to You had just come out in the January of that year. I think it was 1992. And so again, like that video loads won loads and loads of awards as well. And again, it's just her, Sinead, and in all her beauty and her anger and her vulnerability, just staring the camera down. And it was so raw and so just incredible. And then, of course, you know, her appearance on Saturday Night Live. I mean, she was just such... She was such a truth sayer. I mean, she always said that she was a protest singer, not a pop star. She never, and I believe part of her, you know, that it was a deliberate act of self-sabotage on the Saturday Night Live. I mean, obviously it was an act of protest, very much so, her tearing up the photograph of the Pope. But also she did not want what her record company people wanted her to be. She didn't want that life. She wanted to say meaningful things and, you know, live a meaningful artistic life, and I think she did that, even though it was hard.
You mentioned Nothing Compares to You. I was at Dua Lipa last Friday night in the Aviva Stadium, who sang that as a tribute to Sinead O'Connor and did an excellent job on it, but it still wasn't anything like as good as Sinead O'Connor singing what was a Prince song. She had improved on the Prince song.
She'd really improved.
Yeah, enormously, yeah, in the way that he did it.
Yeah.
And Dua Lipa did a really, really good version of it, but it wasn't Sinead O'Connor.
No, yeah. And on that album is Black Boys on Moped, on Mopeds, which is one of my favourite songs. And that happens to be my party piece as well, which is kind of a session killer, really, because it's very dark. But I love that song. It's about Thatcher's England and the killing of a black man by English police. So she was just so political. She always had her finger on the pulse and she was just never afraid. I love that about her.
Then for your favourite band or artist, you've gone for CMAT.
Yes, I love CMAT. I'm in danger of being called an official CMAT stalker because I've now seen her, I'm going to say four times, and I'm going to see her again in Nottingham in November. So that'll be number five. So that makes her the person that I've seen, you know, the live act that I've seen the most in my life.
Why is that? What is it about CMAT?
I've loved her since she came out. I love her look. I love her energy. Again, she's got the red hair, which I always like. I actually bought tickets for my husband for his birthday to see her in Gorilla in Manchester. And he was like, oh, who's this? And I was like, oh, you love her.
So it was a present for yourself, right?
So over we went. I just love her energy on the stage. I love the way she's unapologetically not a, you know, traditional looking pop star. And so it makes her such a powerful role model as well, especially nowadays for young people. But in spite of her like high octane hijinks on the stage, you know, she kind of rides around, she leaps into the crowd. She always presumes they'll catch her. They always do. But, you know, aside from all of that, she just has this searing sensibility. Like, she's an incredible songwriter. And I do think she's the voice of a generation. And she just taps into the emotional heft of a song, you know. And so she can, like, for example, when she played Rent at Gorilla in Manchester. She did an acoustic version of that. That's my favourite theme song. And the crowd was just captivated, you know, and it's, I cried. And that was that moment when I actually fell in love with her.
Well, let's hear her do a different song with a little bit of help from John Grant. Where Are Your Kids Tonight? Matt, Where Are Your Kids Tonight? Ciara, best gig you were ever at. You've nominated Slane Castle, August 2001. Who was in the lineup that night?
Oh, that was a great lineup. That was U2, Coldplay, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Kellis. At the time, her Milkshake song was huge. And then this young Dublin band called JJ72. But to be honest, it wasn't really about the lineup. I just resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to the gig. Because my son had been born in May of that year, Neil, and my daughter, Sive, was 3. And also we were scheduled to be on holidays in Donegal, which we were. And we had invited 2 pals up to the house in Donegal. It's my husband's parents' house, which they'd kindly lent to us for holidays. And so my 2 pals are our friends, Paul Hegarty and Dara O'Leary, came up to us for the weekend. And then I heard that there had been a lottery in work. And I didn't get a ticket. It was for tickets for Slane. But then somebody couldn't make it. And then I was next up. So I got the ticket. So I had to hand the baby to my husband. Neil was, I think, about 3 months old. He was super cranky. He turned out lovely. I have to say that. He did. And I drove at, 7 o'clock in the morning down. Met them in Navan and got on. There was a minivan, you know, it was real.
Of work colleagues.
And then we spent the day on, you know, the Hill of Slane. And it was, you know, one of those days of your life that just stands out because It was just so glorious, you know, the sun shone all day. Now, whether it did or not, who knows? But in my recollection, it was so beautiful. It was warm, it was sunny. I remember sitting sort of at the edge of the amphitheatre, looking down into the pit when the Red Hot Chili Peppers were on, and they, instructed that everyone take off their top and just kind of fling it around their heads like, you know, the blades of a helicopter kind of thing. And I was just looking down as they were playing, and it was just this frenzy of music and sound, and I was just carried away by it. And it was just like a free, I was completely free. And it was probably the first time I hadn't had, you know, the baby with me since he was born, because he was literally 3 months old. So, it was a really, really wonderful gig.
Favourite movie, actor, or director? You've given us a movie, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yeah, I mean, this does really hark back to my Australian days again. It came out when I was in Australia in 1994. And we went to Australia that year. You could get a year visa. I think it's the same thing now. You had to have I think it was $500 in your account. So no, I think it was $1,000. So what we did was we shifted money from Frank's account, that's my husband, to my account. We literally had $1,000 between the 2 of us, I'd say. And so we were there for a year. And I had this vision of Australian men in particular. You know, I suppose I had the Crocodile Dundee image in my head. And, you know, the sort of the beer drinking and calling women Sheilas and all this kind of stuff. I had an idea. I was wrong, by the way, because we lived in Paddington, which was, you know, really LGBTQ plus neighbourhood. And then we went out a lot in King's Cross, which is, you know, absolutely thriving drag queen areas. So this really was not what I had thought Australia was going to be like, and it was wonderful. It was Sydney was at least a very, you know, open and free kind of a place. And then Priscilla, Queen of the Desert is definitely one of my favourite films.
Well, actually, let's just hear a clip from it before you tell us a bit more. Terence Stamp, Hugo Weaving and Guy Pearce are all in this.
Why not? Look, he's turned into a bloody good little performer.
That's right. A bloody good little performer. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I thought we were getting away from all this shit.
Two's company, three's a party, Bernadette, my sweet.
We're unplugging our curling wands and going bush, Felicia. Why would you possibly want to leave all this glamour for a hike into the middle of nowhere?
Do you really want to know?
Desperately.
Well, ever since I was a lad, I've had this dream. A dream that I now, finally, have a chance to fulfill.
And that is?
To travel to the centre of Australia, climb King's Canyon as a queen, in a full-length Gautier sequin, heels and a tiara.
Great. That's just what this country needs.
Oh, get back in your kennels, both of you. Now, the first thing we have to work out is how the hell we're going to get there.
So tell us quickly a little bit about that movie.
Yeah. The funny thing about that movie is Guy Pearce, I knew him as Mike from Neighbours. Neighbours was always on in our house when we were in certainly secondary school. And now here he was playing, Felicia, Jolly Goodfellow, I think is his drag handle, in this film. And he absolutely stole the show from me. They did get an Oscar for Best Costume Design, which was completely well deserved. And their budget for the costumes was $25,000, which even back then was really small when you consider how incredible the outfits are. And the soundtrack also is just unbelievable as well. Guy Pearce for me steals the show. But also Terence Stamp is brilliant as Bernadette. Bernadette is a trans woman, and the Guy Pearce character takes great pleasure in calling her by her old name, Ralph, which infuriates her. So basically, the three of them, they're all drag queens, and they set off in a bus called Priscilla from Sydney. They're going to Alice Springs to perform. There's not a huge amount of plot. It's not a particularly subtle film, but the soundtrack is amazing. Loads of ABBA. You could dance through the entire movie. It's now also a musical. It's basically a road movie, and it's also kind of fish out of water movie. And it's just interspersed with these incredible set pieces where, you know, they're on top of the bus or they're on top of King's Canyon, you know, three cocks in frocks on the rock. As Guy Pearce says.
Okay, we are running tight on time, so I may not be able to play any more clips, but I want to hear about your choices. Funny enough, you have Macbeth down, which I know I'll be seeing again in a few months' time because my youngest fella is doing it for his leaving cert, which means by the time I've watched it with him, it'll probably be about a dozen times that I've seen Macbeth on stage. Okay. Why do you pick it?
Well, kind of the same as you, because my daughter, Grace, is also doing it for her leaving cert. So I have never seen a Shakespeare play performed in a theatre, and I was not a great fan of Shakespeare. I did Hamlet in school, I did The Merchant of Venice, and I did Romeo and Juliet, but only because I really kind of had to. The films, I mean, they're fine, they're better. It certainly wouldn't be my first go-to choice for theatre, because I just find it hard to relate. So it was Grace's birthday. I decided, wouldn't it be nice if we go to London, spend a night, go to the Globe, and Macbeth was on. Now, it was a school's version, so it's an abridged version.
Okay.
It's an hour and a half. But we're in the Globe, which is the original Shakespeare.
I've been in it,
It's actually not the original, but it's a
recreation, and it's terrific.
It's amazing. We had done a tour of it a couple of years before, and I always wanted to go back and see a play there. It was a roasting hot day. I made the terrible mistake of going to Tate before I went to the play. So I walked around for 2 hours, and then
that's not a mistake. The Tate Gallery is wonderful.
Tate, but we had to stand. We were standing at the Globe. Like, the ticket cost £10. Like, it was brilliant. But we had to stand. So that was the only thing. It was an hour and a half of standing. But it absolutely blew me away. And I suppose because I kind of thought I wasn't going to get it, You know, it was going to be, the language was going to be too dense for me, but it was an incredibly, it was a very young cast. They were dressed in contemporary clothes. They had iPads and iPhones. They were very acrobatic, energetic. The dance scenes were like choreographed. They were like dances. And we were allowed to bring chips in as well. So it was all, it was like the perfect day.
And you also have Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag as a one-woman show.
Yeah. That was the original. It was originally a play,
Before the television series.
Yeah. So it was performed. She performed it in Soho in London and then brought it up to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival where she performed it. And in fairness, I've actually haven't seen the live performance, but I saw it on Galentine's Day in the Lighthouse Cinema a good few years ago now with my pal Bernie Furlong. And it, so they showed the live show on the screen, if you like. But it's absolutely captivating. The fact that she can tell this unnamed narrator can tell such a nuanced and layered story just by a monologue, you know, and it's something, it's really, really captivating and just fascinating.
Brilliant. Okay, books. You've given us three books. First one, a memoir, Christine Dwyer Hickey, Tatty. She was with us here last year and she's a terrific character.
I adore Christine Dwyer Hickey. I'm one of her major big fans. Anytime I meet her, I've met her maybe twice and I kind of fangirl her, but she's kind of very self-deprecating, and she shouldn't be, because she is one of, I think, Ireland's most talented writers. She's incredible. She's so diverse in her work, you know, and she can kind of turn her hand to anything. I would read her grocery shopping list. It would be fascinating. Tatty, it's a semi-autobiographical, but I'm pretty sure it is based on her life growing up in, and it's about a Dublin childhood. From say the mid 60s, there's 10 chapters. Each chapter, Tatty is the main character. It starts when she's three, and then she goes up in age by 1 year per chapter. So it ends when she's 13. And I love books that are told through with a child's voice. I think basically Tatty inspired me to write my novel Lifesaving for Beginners, because I used a child's voice. I think it's incredibly affecting because you can tell. It's quite a harrowing childhood. There's neglect there. There's addiction. There's alcoholism, as an adult reader, you see the dangers and you see what's happening. But through the child's eyes, they're telling it with a completely different perspective. You know, it's all great fun going with her dad to the pub, and she's sent over to the bookies to place the bets for all the dad's pals, and she's sat up on the bar stool and given the pint of Guinness to sup. You know.
Fiction, Emma Donoghue's Haven.
Emma Donoghue is another writer who is incredibly versatile and literally can write anything she puts her mind to, you know. And Haven is one of my favourites. It was shortlisted for the International Dublin Literary Award. And honestly, I don't think I would have read this book had it been written by somebody else, because it's literally set on, they call it Greig Skellig, but it's Skellig Michael, in the year 600. And it features three monks. You know, there's nothing about that really that would kind of, you know,
appeal to you.
Not really, you know. So, but I love this book, and it's an adventure story. And basically, it's three monks, and they head off from Clonmacnoise on the banks of the Shannon in this little leaky wooden rowing boat, and they want to find an island where they can, you know, just sort of commune with God and draw and write text from the Bible. That's it, really. But her attention to detail in relation to the natural world is incredible, and that she's a lot to say about climate change as well.
Ciara, we've gone so far over time. I'm going to have to start winding this up. I know you had The Springs of Affection by Maeve Brennan as your favourite short stories. You also had, for your cultural buried treasure, the New Ireland Open Door series of books edited by Patricia Scanlon. So I wanted to mention those. I want to finish, though, just a little bit, chatting to you a little bit about the television that has influenced you. You're definitely a child of my era, because Charlie's Angels is one of your children's picks.
Yes, Charlie's Angels. Oh, my God. And it was back in the day, in the olden days, listen up, kids, this is what we had to do. Like, your favourite TV programme would be on, say, on a Friday night for 1 hour, and that would be it. Then you'd have to wait for the next Friday to get the next instalment of the show. Charlie's Angels, I just have great memories of looking forward to it and really enjoying it. It was these, you know, and I mean, oh, like it was really the male gaze when I look back at it now with my adult eyes, because they were these three absolutely beautiful detectives with their, you know, their bouncy bobs, and their long layers, and their high heels.
Farrah Fawcett replaced by Cheryl Ladd for the second
That's
series.
Right.
I remember things like that too.
And
yeah,
they were just gorgeous. But they, I mean, they were whip smart as well.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, they had guns. And so they worked for this guy who we never see. We just kind of see the back of him, called Charlie Townsend. And they're detectives, because they went, you know, they were police, you know, detective, you know, police officers, but they were given really crappy jobs, like, you know, meter maids and crossing guards and stuff. So Charlie hires them as detectives. And like the flirtation between them and Charlie is actually cringe now when you look back.
Yes, I think the voice was John Forsyth, who
That's
played
right.
in Dynasty. Anyway,
yeah.
Look, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to talk to you about your love of Catastrophe with Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney, because we are out of time. You've been brilliant. Ciara Geraghty, thank you so much for going through all your Culture Club choices. Big thank you to my entire production team. We will be back tomorrow at 4:30. Until then, for me, Matt Cooper, have a very good evening.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.